all across America and around the world. This is Veterans Radio.
This is Veterans Radio.
And welcome to Veterans Radio. I am Jim Fossone with VeteransRadio.net. We are recording today from the Legal Help for Veterans studio in Northville, Michigan. Legal Help for Veterans is a veterans disability law firm. You can reach us at 800-693-4800.
We want to welcome to Veterans Radio today, Taras Lysenko, a Army veteran who, with his colleague Alan Olson, are the founders and owners of A&T Recovery, which has is involved in a fascinating slice of military history. Taras, welcome to Veterans Radio.
Thank you for having me.
Well, let's start, because you both are Army veterans. Why don't we start there, and then we'll come back around to how you got yourself involved in this interesting endeavor. Tell us about your military experience.
Well, I'm a commissioned officer, branched infantry, ranger qualified, and it was a fun part of my life, interesting part of my life. And in the 80s under Ronald Reagan, so it was I called him the great commander. I don't know what other people called him, but that's what I called him. Al is considerably older than me. He is actually considered Vietnam era, but he didn't participate in Vietnam. And he worked on, I think it was Pershing missiles in Germany. It was maintenance on Pershing missiles in Germany. So that's pretty much it.
That's a great experience for what you were doing at A&T Recovery. Not really. It has nothing to do with what you do at A&T Recovery. So let's talk about how a couple of Chicago boys dreamed up the idea about A&T Recovery.
You just used the term boys. And I try to get this across to people to always see the world through the eyes of a child. Sometimes they say the eyes of a puppy. If you notice puppies and children, they have this great sense of wonder about everything they see. And the trouble is, we become adults and we lose that sense of wonder. And we get into this routine of just going to work 9 to 5 for 40 years and planning for retirement. And that is something we never, ever, ever thought about. And there was a philosopher named Alan Watts, and I had never heard of him until recently, but he did this wonderful thing. What do you desire? Alan Watts, what do you desire? And he said, we have it all wrong. And I think Alan, I, and the rest of our crew all along knew that we all had it wrong. And what we should do as humans, we should not just exist, we should really live. And the way to live is to do what you desire. And so we have always sort of looked at the world like through the eyes of a child, just looking for wonder. What's around the rock? What's under the rock? Under that rock? What's around the side of that mountain? We've always explored, no matter where we are. You can drop us in any part of the planet and we'll start exploring almost instantly. There was a comic strip years ago, Calvin and Hobbes, where I give students, when I give a presentation, I give them a copy of the one where he's digging in the ground and his stuffed tiger says to him, why are you digging that hole in the ground? He said, I'm hunting for treasure. And the tiger asks him, have you found anything? And he says, a bunch of disgusting grubs, these worms, these rocks, there's treasure everywhere. And that's kind of how we look at things. We just know there's some sort of interesting something. You can call it treasure or whatever you want to call it, but there's something everywhere to be seen and discovered.
Well, what you were discovering, and again, this started when you guys were just young men, was this idea that there were World War II aircraft that had crashed in Lake Michigan off of the Chicago area because of the training that was done outside Chicago to make folks aircraft carrier qualified. So tell us a little bit about kind of how that piqued your interest.
Well, so this is before we did college and military and before we did that, and we were at least I was a teenager. Maybe I have to correct that. Al actually had done that stuff, and I was still the teenager. And so we were scuba divers from early on, young ages, we became scuba divers. And just so you know, we went to the same grade school, the same high school. Kind of thing. So I've known Al since I was 3 years old when I moved onto the street where he was already living on with his family. But we actually were scuba divers, and Al had this idea of buying this boat that was pretty bad. I swear it was literally held together with duct tape. And so we went out of the lake. We knew about the ships. We knew Chicago had been one of the busiest ports in the 1800s. So we were looking for ships. And a scuba group located a TBF Avenger, torpedo bomber Avenger type, the type that George Bush Sr. would have flown in the war. And so that's when we found out about the aircraft. Well, we shifted our attention. And it didn't take us long. It was less than a year. Al and I located a Wildcat fighter. So we actually turned that over to a private salvage company, and they actually salvaged it for a guy named Pelage, who owns those, I think it's 57 Aero Squadron restaurants. And he made a deal with the Navy that he could have it or whatever. I don't know exactly the details because I was young and flippant. I was still a teenager. And so anyway, I college, military, and came back, and Al said, you know, we should turn this looking for the aircraft into a business. And I had money, he had money, and we bought a much better boat. And we bought the equipment needed, which was called side scan sonar, to actually find the aircraft. And boy, did we find aircraft.
It's really amazing how many you've found, and we're going to talk about those. And these are all in a book that Taras has written called The Great Navy Birds of Lake Michigan.
Yes, thank you for the pitch of the book.
Oh, no, it's a caption, the true story of the privateers of Lake Michigan and the aircraft they rescued. Well, you rescued over 40 or so aircraft from Lake Michigan and elsewhere. But this isn't an easy – a couple of things here. This isn't – they're not easy to find, and then you get into this whole issue of who really owns them. Let's start with – these aren't easy to find, are they?
They're not easy to find, and it's all about logistics. And one thing – I'm the gregarious public face of A&T Recovery, but Al is the electronic – how you put the vessel and the equipment together to do it expert. I would say he's a genius with electronics. It's amazing. And then together with our other crew members, Keith Pearson and Paul and Bruce, and we a number of others, they're able to fabricate anything needed on the fly. When we're operating, we're army. We get into trouble, something goes wrong, we don't quit. We figure out how to fix it.
Right? There's always another way up that hill, isn't there?
You might be digging under it, right? Well, you might be tunneling. Who knows? Right?
And reading the book, one of the interesting things is you do hit. Okay, you found it. Okay, side scan radar helped you out. The ship logs probably didn't help you out. Where exactly it crashed? Nobody GPSed it at the time. There's no black box that's working for you. All of that, you find it.
We still find it.
Now you have to pick it up off the ground. Yeah, pick it out of the lake bottom. Not an easy task, is it?
No, and it's not an easy task because of our wonderful, and I don't want to complain at all, but our government has too many tentacles interfering with too much stuff where they shouldn't, and they should sometimes just sit back and let us do what we do. And every bureaucrat needs to put their stamp of approval on it. And so I say my book is really – the title is misleading. It's not really so much in my mind about the aircraft. It's about American humanities. It's an actual micro study of – well, my observation, my personal view of how our government doesn't really help ourselves. It doesn't let us help ourselves. So the aircraft are owned by the U.S. Navy. All right, and there go for the American population. And the reason for that is I use an example. I say if you're walking through a parking lot of a grocery store and you drop your wallet and someone else finds it, it's not their wallet. It's still your wallet, right? You lost it. Same thing applies to the aircraft. The U.S. government lost the aircraft in Lake Michigan. And so you have to go to the U.S. government and say, to specifically the Navy, and say, we'd like to do something with this. And they have to grant you permission. They can either divest themselves of ownership. Now, for years, we've had this thing called Admiralty law, the laws of fines and the laws of salvage, which says, doesn't say you own it because you found it underwater. It says the owner should compensate you for helping what's been lost, return what's lost. So we actually were able to work with the National Naval Aviation Museum. I think I said that right. National Naval Aviation Museum director and deputy director. In those days, it was Captain Robert Rasmussen and Buddy Macon, that was the director and the deputy director, and they found a way for us to work with the U.S. Navy to recover those 40 or so aircraft. And because of their determination, as well as ours, we were able to get all those aircraft recovered, restored, on display at almost two dozen prestigious museums across the country, including their museum, the National Museum of the United States Marine Corps, the National Museum of the Pacific War, Pearl Harbor Aviation Museum, Kalamazoo Aviation History Museum, also known as the Kalamazoo Air Zoo, Cradle of Aviation, Long Island, New York, the aircraft carriers Yorktown, Lexington, Midway. So additionally, some of the aircraft were, because they understood this, that the population needs better chances to see them, a number of the aircraft we were allowed to, they exchanged them for us in a sense of payment and to other people for things. And they've been returned to the public. And there's aircraft that have come out of Lake Michigan that were restored to flying condition and are seen at air shows across the country every year.
Well, it's really amazing. The book talks about how, well, it's the government's aircraft still. We're spending all the effort and time in raising this, but we can't get paid for it. We've got to get something in that's traded like bartering exchange for it. It isn't finders keepers. It's really, you might be lucky enough to get a reward.
Yeah. And they don't make it easy. They really don't make it easy. It's amazing all the entire permitting process. There was a Navy lawyer that said, well, we think the permitting process takes about a year. And it's aside from seeing why, you know, the people did not understanding how to find them. When you look at the average person doesn't have all the expertise to find them and then to go through the government stuff. And that's why we were able to put together a team that could figure out how to do all that. And then when the Navy stopped using that exchange thing and shut off the exchange thing, we had to go raise private money. And it's very interesting, the private money that came in to support the recovery, restoration, and public display of these aircraft. Enterprise Rent-A-Car, well, Enterprise Holdings, which owns Enterprise Rent-A-Car, CEO and son of founder. A lot of people don't know Enterprise was named after the Enterprise aircraft carrier because the founder, Jack Taylor, was a Hellcat pilot aboard the USS Enterprise during World War II. So in honor of his father and that ship and the men, his son, Andy Taylor, sponsored the recovery and restoration of a Hellcat fighter. McDonald's Corporation, which was under at the time was under direction of a man named Fred Turner, who I think was the second CEO after Ray Kroc, backed at least three of the recovery restoration display projects. And that's an interesting story. And then there's other people such as a man named Chuck Greenhill, who sponsored two of the recoveries and restorations. So and the Navy can't help us do that. The Navy can't help us raise money to do this stuff. Well, we have to go do it.
I want to go back to the challenge of actually lifting these airframes, which have been sitting on the bottom in Lake Michigan. At least it's freshwater, but you've also had recoveries elsewhere, sitting on the bottom 150 feet or 100 feet below the surface, or all kinds.
How about 400?
Okay. I mean, those of us who's ever scuba dived knows that the pressure is building. This is a logistical challenge and different each and every time, I suspect. Can you tell us a little bit about that?
Well, all the aircraft, Navy aircraft, World War II, were designed to be lifted. And you understand that because, say, an aircraft carrier pulls into port, it might have aircraft that are damaged beyond what the aircraft carrier has capabilities to repair, so it's got to be lifted off the ship onto the dock and taken to repair facilities. So they're all designed to be that way, except for the design works if the aircraft is standing on its wheels the way it's built, right? The design doesn't work if it's flipped over, twisted on the side, half upside down. Right? So they could be in any position because when they crash in the water, they don't just gently flutter to the bottom. They flip and spin and twist and right because they have control surfaces, which might be called air surfaces or whatever. So we never know exactly how the aircraft is going to be. So say we have an aircraft that's 300 feet deep. We videotape it with what's called remote operated vehicles, ROVs, what they call them. It's an underwater robot is what it is that we control from the surface. And it's got a nice camera and it has what we call manipulators, which are mechanical hands or arms, which can be anything. It can cut, it can grab, it can attach things. My joke always is because we tease each other about operating those things. And my joke is we need to hire some 14-year-old video game players because they
absolutely they have the skill set. Yes, absolutely.
Yeah. So anyway, it's a very lengthy, tedious thing. But as I said before, you know, Al, Keith, Paul, Bruce, it can fabricate just about anything we need. So no matter how the aircraft is resting on the bottom, they can figure out how to pick it up. Generally, they can figure. And we have all the engineer drawings of the aircraft and what's called the erection maintenance manuals, where we know how to disassemble them, assemble them. We have got guys like Pete and Ty who are AMP mechanics or even aircraft inspectors that just can look at that stuff and tell us, you know, hey, you need this here and you need that there. So we put together an absolutely unbelievable team that does this really well. We have Todd, who's just great with logistics it's one of those things, you know, the stars line up. Our team lines up because they just whatever weaknesses one has, one of the other ones makes up for it. And
well, it's the kind of project where you never know what you're going to walk into. So having that kind of team is important. And we're talking to Taras Lysenko, who is the one of the founders and the author of a new book called The Great Navy Birds of Lake Michigan, put out by the America Through Time, which is an imprint of Font Hill Media LLC. The pictures in this, Taras, are amazing and worth the book right there. I think you really tell the story through the pictures of the airplanes that you find both on the bottom and as you bring them up to the surface. They're in all kinds of different conditions, aren't they?
Oh, yeah. The one thing about it, nice thing about it, in general, the crashes were you would call them a ditching because they were either generally on takeoff or on landing to the makeshift aircraft carriers. So they're not like combat crashes where, you know, they were fighting a Japanese Zero and the pilot got hit by a round and killed. So the aircraft went into the water at, you know, 300 miles an hour. They generally were at close to stall, very close to stall speed, and I don't think you want me to get into all the pilot stuff, but basically the stall speed, landing speed, takeoff speed, right? They were just at that point. So generally their damage isn't too bad. Now you see some of them that actually impacted the water wrong and the wings are, the front end edges of the wings are folded back and that kind of stuff. And pilots, if in the accidents reports, the pilots would hit their faces on the instrument panels and fracture their skulls sometimes. And but in general, that's pretty good. But there are ones where they lost their engine power on takeoff and crashed right in front of the ship and the ship hit them. And so, you know, that aircraft is going to have a lot of damage. Interesting thing, we've recovered at least two aircraft that I know of that happened, and both pilots survived. And I talk about having nine lives. those pilots used a few of them in those instances. But you look at the aircraft and they're heavily damaged by the ship.
And anybody who's ever been in the service knows, and our veteran radio listeners would know, training accidents, training in the military is a serious, dangerous business. And this just sort of highlights all that. But I want to swing a little bit from the recovery to the restoration. It's one thing to pull these things out of the water and just let all the mud and the goop and drain out of them. But almost all of them then get restored. And that's got to take years and dollars. Who does the restoration?
I've got to say A&T Recovery doesn't do restoration. It is a tedious artisan work. And our hats off to these restorers. And most of them are volunteers. And the sad thing is most of them are in their 80s and 90s. They're generally retired people that have done something else, and they're brilliant. Funny thing, we look at something and say, oh, my God. They look at it and say, oh, that's a wonderful challenge. They take years. And for many years, the main restoration of these aircraft was being done at the National Naval Aviation Museum until the Naval History and Heritage Command shut down their restoration facilities. And I won't go into that, but if you read the book, you see what they did. But we were fortunate. The Kalamazoo Aviation History Museum, or the Air Zoo, stepped up to expand their restoration facilities. So if you're anywhere in Michigan or the Midwest, it's a great thing to go. They allow actually the public to participate in restoration, which is really interesting. We began a project by requesting of Dick and Betsy DeVos, our present education secretary, that they have a charter school called West Michigan Aviation Academy. We made a request to them that they bring their students to become involved in the restoration of some of these aircraft, and they responded to that right away and favorably. And so we began with the West Michigan Aviation Academy students back by 2013 or 2014. And since then, schools all across the region, I would call it the South Central Michigan region, all the way as far as Chicago. The Chicago has high school military academies. Their students come and work on them. So it's middle school students all the way through university level students. And then lots of members of the public participate in the restoration of these aircraft now.
Well, and as you said earlier, these aircraft, once restored, have ended up all over the country, as far away as Pearl Harbor and San Diego, at different museums, the National World War II Museum. So somebody's doing a whole lot of restoration work to keep this history alive, which is what you're really bringing to the table, isn't it? Bringing history alive.
Yes, that's I talk about the Naval History and Heritage Command. Well, part of their mission is to make naval history come alive. Well, I would argue that they're not doing it, but we are. All of us from the National Naval Aviation Museum, the Air Zoo, all these other museums, all these restorers, it takes thousands of people to participate to make this work. And so it's thousands of people doing what their mission is.
Well, you're out talking to different groups. I know you're coming to the Yankee Air Museum in Ypsilanti, Michigan, and they're working on a plane restoration for their museum. It's really that hands-on that I suspect you find motivates people to be involved in this work.
You know, people like the real thing. If show them a photograph of an aircraft or show them a video, so what? But if they can go and actually see machines built by the men and women of the greatest generation that were used to protect the world's liberty and freedom, that's what they want to see. And that's where they learn. And they can, in the Midway airports, or the Chicago airports, Chicago O'Hare and Midway, those are the most viewed naval artifacts in all the Navy's collection. And millions of people a year stop and press the little buttons or read the plaques that just tell them about things such as Butch O'Hare and the Battle of Midway. and they see the two aircraft recovered from Lake Michigan. And so every year, just those two aircraft educate millions of people, because most of our society has forgotten all that. They've forgotten that the greatest generation protected us.
Well, and that's why we like telling these stories on Veterans Radio, because so many people would never have really connected the dots about the training out of Great Lakes, the birds that crashed into Lake Michigan. And we're talking to Taras Lysenko, founder of A&T Restoration. He's recently written a book called The Great Navy Birds of Lake Michigan. And Taras, if folks want to find out maybe where you're speaking next or where the next plane is going to, is there some way that they can stay in touch with you and know what's going on in this area?
There are authors pages, but those are hard. I do a lot of posting on Facebook, LinkedIn. It's really easy to connect up or follow me on any one of those things. Believe it or not, my email is all over the internet. My phone number is all over the internet. So I actually say, more importantly than following me, is if people know an organization that would like a talk, I do lots of them. I think over the past 30 years, I've done 1,000, and I do them all the time. I have yet to say no to any group. I've given presentations to as small numbers as 6 and as many as several thousand. And so it's real easy. If they know how to spell my name, they just put that into Google, and it's real easy. They can contact me through any number of ways. My email address, my phone number, Facebook, LinkedIn. There's an interesting story in the book about the use of LinkedIn. I don't know if you were able to see it, but it's a heart-wrenching story. But I recommend people read it, because it talks about, even though we win in a war, there's a lot of pain for even the winners.
Oh, so, absolutely. Yeah. Let me help our listeners out. It's Taras, T-A-R-A-S, Lysenko, L-Y-S-S-E-N-K-O. And I hope they reach out and follow you on Facebook and LinkedIn and sort of stay in touch with what you do. And we really appreciate you taking some time to talk to us here today on Veterans Radio.
Well, thank you for the opportunity, and keep up the good work.
And I want to thank everybody for listening to Veterans Radio today. I am Jim Fossone. It's been a pleasure to be your host. I'm a veterans disability lawyer at Legal Help for Veterans, and you can reach us at 800-693-4800 or legalhelpforveterans.com on the web. You can follow Veterans Radio on Facebook and listen to its podcasts and internet radio shows by going to veteransradio.net. And until next time, you are dismissed.
If you have a VA claim denied by the Board of Veterans Appeals, contact Legal Help for Veterans at 1-800-693-4800. They're experts in handling cases before the U.S. Court of Appeals for Veterans Claims. Their number again, 1-800-693-4800.
Veterans Radio needs you. If you like our shows that are informative, surprising stories, and relevant information on what's happening at the VA and the military, we'd like your support. Individual support of $5 to $50 a month, or corporate sponsorship of $1,000 to $10,000 would be welcomed. You can go to veteransradio.net, click on the sponsorship or support tab, pay online, and keep Veterans Radio on the air.